We are looking to the past for insights into the future. Scientists around the world are trying to understand how this new coronavirus works and what we can use to make it less deadly or even prevent people from getting sick in the first place. And we find ourselves thinking about epidemics of the past. That includes polio. No one knew how people got it. Kids were paralyzed and died, finally after decades, a vaccine. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about what it took to stop polio from being a constant looming threat to our health. And we want to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Do you remember a time before the polio vaccine was developed and available? Did you or your friends get polio? Did you know someone in your family who experienced it? Share your story with us. Help us understand that context at 800-642-1234. Our guest is Dr. Gareth Williams. He's an emeritus professor of medicine at the University of Bristol. He's written or co-authored more than 20 books, including Paralyzed with Fear, The Story of Polio. Dr. Williams, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
We saw polio epidemics spring up around the world starting in the 1890s. People were paralyzed, people died, and that vaccine didn't become available until 1954. What was it like when polio was at its peak in the 40s and 50s before we got this vaccine to people?
It was pretty horrendous. It was an annual curse. The polio season used to come around in late spring, early summer. And some countries, particularly the U.S., in fact, were literally paralyzed with fear at the threat of this thing dropping out of the sky again. In fact, you have to wind back to 1916 to discover why polio exerted such a grip on populations around the world. 1916 was the year of the great polio epidemic on the east coast of the U.S., and it hit particularly hard New York State, New York City. And in the city, it left about 10,000 people paralyzed and 2,500 people dead. And this was just in the months between July and December. And the thing that really left the scars, pretty indelible scars, really, on the American psyche and lots of other populations around the world was that whatever the doctors and the experts and the public health people tried to do to stop this epidemic, all the measures failed. So they tried everything. They tried getting rid of flies. They tried scrubbing the sidewalks clean, millions of gallons of water a day. They shot tens of thousands of cats because they thought cats might be transmitting it. They declared war on flies. They did everything, and everything that they did basically failed. So at the end of this, go on, sorry. Yeah.
I wanted to touch on that because the one of the problems is that people didn't understand how it was spreading, so it was hard to combat it.
That's exactly right. They knew by then that it was a virus, but they had no idea what sort of a virus it was. And very little was known about viruses then anyway. So that it was smaller than a bacterium. That was basically all that they knew. And they had no idea how it was spread. There was a theory from important people in the Rockefeller Institute in New York that the virus got into the nose and then traveled up the nerves, at the smell nerves, if you like, at the top of the nose into the brain, and that's how the virus got in. In fact, we know now that it was spread by what's indelicately known as the fecal-oral route, so basically in heading south from the teeth and down through the gut. But back then, they had no idea, and that, as you say, really constrained them in what they were trying to do to stamp the outbreak out.
Was social distancing something that people tried during the polio epidemics? I mean, that's certainly what we're working to do right now with the new coronavirus.
Well, it was actually worse than that, because if somebody got polio during that first big outbreak, then the whole of the family was shut in the house unless the patient was at death's door. If there were more than a couple of houses affected in a street, then the whole street was locked down, a complete no-go zone. And in the end, there were whole districts in New York that were just boarded up and shut off. And again, because they thought flies might be transmitting polio, there were instructions to use fly screens and bolt the windows shut. And it was a very long, hot summer, so it must have been hell on earth.
Certainly. And if you weren't allowed to leave your section of houses, it would be nearly impossible to distance socially. I understand, though, that people who had money had more of an opportunity to try to keep away from polio as far as social distancing goes, right? Because many of them could leave or travel.
Well, they did. Even during that first outbreak, they were able to get permits for children to leave the city. So about 1,000 kids a day were leaving during the late summer. They had to get permits from doctors to say that they were free from the disease. But the trouble with polio, as it appears to be with coronavirus, is that you can look relatively well. You don't certainly have to be paralyzed. Only a few percent of people actually got clinical paralysis. So you could be walking around feeling in pretty good shape. So the doctor would say you're free from disease, but actually you were infected, which meant that you would then carry the infection out of the lockdown zone into wherever you were going. And as you imply, later on after that, at the start of the polio season each year, people would flee the cities. They'd go down to the coast or they'd go up into the mountains in the belief that they'd be able to stay away from polio. But it's one of those illnesses that just had a habit of seeking people out wherever they went.
There are some ideas about the fact that perhaps the new coronavirus will wane during the summer and come back. We see that with influenza. Is that what happened with polio? Why was it worse in the summertime?
Well, they never sorted out the full epidemiology of polio and its seasonal variation. But the fact was that it tended to reappear in late spring, and epidemics would generally die out through the late autumn into the winter, although some, including the New York one of 1916, actually carried on until the early months of 1917. So it was a seasonal illness. And again, we still never really got to the bottom of why that was, but it had a very pronounced seasonal pattern to it. Yeah.
Dr. Gareth Williams is the author of Paralyzed with Fear, The Story of Polio. And we're talking about how the polio epidemics happened and the lessons that we can learn from them. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Craig from Sturgeon Bay is on the line now to talk with us. Hi, Craig.
Hi. I had a comment that has more to do with how the scarce vaccine at the time was distributed. And the comment is that the way it was distributed could be a model for how the scarce personal protective gear could be distributed today. And it also includes ventilators and so on. And that is, as I understand it, the U.S. Public Health Service was the central point of contact for the 40 different pharmaceutical labs that had contracts. And they procured it, and then also then were the ones in charge of getting that to the different state departments of public health, who then distributed through the schools. And it was the physician coordinators in each state who then had to keep the contact back with the Department of Public Health.
Yeah, Craig, let's get back to Dr. Gareth Williams quick to find out, is that how we made sure that people got the vaccine right away? And could we deploy that kind of strategy again with other things?
Well, Craig's absolutely right. That was the initial strategy. In fact, when the first clinical trials were done with the Salk vaccine in the early 50s, the bottom line was that it works and it's safe. And instantly, mass vaccination was rushed in for all the kids across the U.S. And the problem was that one of those 40 vaccine companies that Craig mentions was actually a bit of a cowboy outfit. They're based outside Berkeley in California, and their health and safety regulations were hopeless. And they managed to contaminate a batch of the vaccine. This was a killed poliovirus vaccine. They managed to contaminate a whole batch with live virulent polio virus. So that meant that there was an outbreak of paralytic polio in some of the vaccinated kids, not only killed and paralyzed them, but did the same to some of their parents. So this was a huge PR catastrophe just after the launch. So Craig's right, that was the strategy. And indeed, that was carried on further with the elimination of the rogue outfit, if you like, that had produced the dangerous batch. And that's, again, how that is going to factor into the model for distributing the coronavirus vaccine when eventually it comes through, I really do not know. I hope that it's going to be a multinational effort, because this is a global plague that we're all confronting. And this is not a time to play sort of national or state level politics. In the UK, we have a similar sort of dilemma at the minute with the four nations all doing slightly different things. But at least I think that if we get a vaccine that works, it will be distributed equitably.
Greg, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234 to share your perspective as we are talking about polio. And there is a line for you at 800-642-1234. Share your story. Help us understand what polio looked like for your family. If you heard stories about people being concerned or if you experienced it in the 40s and 50s, give us a call at 800-642-1234. And Dr. Williams, it seems like there is some sort of similarity between polio and the new coronavirus, especially in the fact that it just kind of suddenly appeared, right? How did we get polio? It just happened.
Well, that's a really good point. And the more the coronavirus story goes on, the more I'm reminded of the parallels with the polio story. I mentioned the outbreak in 1916. That was the really big, bad one. It was also the very first time that polio, if you like, really declared its hand. And as you mentioned in the introduction, there were little outbreaks in the years before that. It was described sort of at the end of the century previously. But most of these outbreaks were small scale and they just picked off a handful of kids and then melted away again. And for some reason we don't know, polio changed its nature at the beginning of the last century and became this huge epidemic monster. And it's unfortunate that its first big victim, if you like, was the East Coast of the U.S. and New York State during the summer of 1916.
All right. And this morning we have Dr. Gareth Williams with us, an emeritus professor of medicine at the University of Bristol. And we're talking about polio and how those epidemics worked, how we figured some things out about the disease and what we might be able to take away from it today. This conversation continues here on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're thinking about COVID-19 through the lens of another epidemic, polio. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Polio killed and paralyzed millions of children until a vaccine became widely available in 1954. And we're talking about why it took so long, and we're considering what's changed in public health strategy since. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. What do you want to know about polio? Dr. Gareth Williams wrote a book about the story of polio, and he's sharing his insights about that disease with us. And we had John from Mequon call, and he says his father grew up in Milwaukee, and his dad and uncle spent summers in Burlington during the polio outbreak. So John giving us an example of a family who tried to flee those tightly packed cities during polio season for sure. Dr. Williams, you have a personal connection to the search for a polio vaccine. What is that?
Well, I did, and I'd completely forgotten about this until I was most of the way through the book and talking about it with my mother. And she reminded me that when I was four, I was involved as a guinea pig in one of the very early clinical trials of a polio vaccine. And at the time, we lived in Belfast in Northern Ireland, and the professor in charge of infectious diseases at Queen's University was a friend of my parents. He'd been approached by a rather maverick scientist and vaccine person called Hilary Koprowski, worked at a drug company in New York, to say that he had developed an early polio vaccine, which at the time was the first, came in before the Salk vaccine even, and would George Dick, this professor, like to try it out? So he nobbled my dad over lunch at Queen's and apparently asked him if he had any kids. And my father said, yes, I think so. And George Dick said, well, I've just put my daughters into this clinical trial. Can I have your kids for the same thing? And my dad said, yeah, carry on, do what you like. So he did. And it didn't mean very much to me at the time, except that I got to visit George Dick's lab. And it was an astonishing place and probably one of the things that made me want to do medicine, in fact. But the interesting thing about the trial was that none of us came to harm. It was a very early experimental vaccine, and it actually went wrong. And it turned out that this supposedly harmless live virus which had been altered in Koprowski's lab and was supposed not to cause paralysis, just induce immunity, actually had the effect, once it had been through the gut of children, in a small proportion of cases, actually turned into a virus that could actually paralyze experimental monkeys. So the outcome of that was that the man coordinating the trial in Belfast wrote a series of articles saying that the polio vaccine in its current state is not safe, and that he would need a lot of convincing with the safety of any polio vaccine. And that meant that even when the Salk vaccine had passed its test in the US, people in the UK were very, very slow to take it up because, if you like, the waters are still poisoned by this freak experience and the trial in Belfast.
Hmm. I love that you got halfway through the book writing it and then rediscovered this information that was so close to what you were working on.
Absolutely.
We've got Joanna in Monona on the phone ready to talk with us. Hi, Joanna.
Hi. First of all, I just want to remind people, Jerry Epp has written a book about his personal experience with polio called Limping Through Life. My aunt had polio, and she got it in the mid-50s when she was pregnant with my cousin. But she had a successful birth, and she went on to have two more kids. It affected the muscles in the back of her neck, so she could never hold her head upright. And if you were sitting down and she wanted to look you in the eye, she would have to put her hand under her chin. And I was in kindergarten in 1954. And I remember when they vaccinated everybody in the school and we got in these lines and waited to have our turn to get the shot. And while we were in line, we carefully looked at the faces of everybody coming out of the room who'd already had the shot to see what they looked like.
Joanna, thank you for sharing those stories with us. Dr. Williams, what do we know about how polio affects a person's body? I mean, obviously, much of it is permanent, as Joanna's aunt shows us.
Well, that's a very interesting story from Joanna, and again, thank you for that. There are some wonderful photographs of kids waiting in line to be vaccinated. And Joanna's point about looking at the faces and the expressions is a very telling one indeed. What happened to her aunt is pretty typical, in that you're left with a degree of paralysis if you're unlucky. On the other side of the coin, most people who got polio either had a very mild illness or didn't know that they had anything wrong with them at all. And the lucky 95% basically got away with it. The unlucky 5% are the ones who had the virus getting into the nerve cells in the spinal cord that drive the muscles and left them with a degree of paralysis. There's a new problem for people who survived polio and might have had it 40 or 50 years ago. And this is a condition that's only recently been recognized. And in fact, many doctors still don't know that it is a true thing. And this is what's known as post-polio syndrome. And this is where, if you take the example of Joanna's aunt, she might not have been able to lift her chin, but she would have been able to do that by popping her hand underneath. Somebody with post-polio syndrome or PPS might actually then go on 40 years later to lose the strength in the arm that you'd used to push your chin up. So this is only now being recognized. And here in the UK, we have an association called the British Polio Fellowship. You've got very similar organizations in the US, and they're actually fighting for the rights of people, the long-term survivors of polio, to have this condition recognized and to make due allowance for it in society.
Dr. Gareth Williams is author of Paralyzed with Fear, The Story of Polio. And now we have Janet from Madison, who is ready to talk with us. Hi, Janet.
Hi. My mother had polio twice, once in the 30s and once in the 40s. And Dr. Salk told her that it was patients like her that struck fear in his heart because they didn't know at the time if there were, you know, one strain of polio or 1,000. But because of her, they knew there were more than one in patients like her. Anyway, in the early 1950s, she drove my two older brothers to Ann Arbor, Michigan, 40 miles to have them take part in the vaccine trials. And my question for you is, what were my brothers doing? What were they getting in Ann Arbor with those vaccine trials?
Well, Janet, let's see if Dr. Williams can answer something of that question.
Well, the first thing to say is that Janet's mother illustrated a very important point, and it might have frightened Dr. Salk initially, but when Salk perfected his vaccine or developed it, it actually had representatives of all three strains of poliovirus in it, so that it would provide complete protection against any of the strains of polio. There are about 200 different strains, possibly more, but they all fall under three broad groups. We call the types. Type 1 was the commonest, type 2 relatively less common, type 3 rather rare. So your mother would have had one of the other types and then probably type 1, looking at the dates involved. As to her brothers, well, they would have been queuing up in Ann Arbor for the Salk vaccine. That was the first one to come through, the injectable one, based on killed polioviruses. And as you know, the one by Albert Sabin, which was quite different, it was still polioviruses, but they were live, and they'd been modified by putting them through unusual circumstances in the laboratory. And they were taken by mouth. So you have the injectable one, which goes into a muscle in the arm. That's the Salk one of dead or inactivated poliovirus. And then you have the drops, which in our day would have been put onto a sugar lump. Sugar lump now omitted because of the risk of dental caries. And this is what you see the very, very brave, courageous volunteers doing, particularly in Pakistan, Afghanistan, going around putting these pink drops into the mouths of the kids during the global vaccination campaign.
All right. Dr. Gareth Williams, I know we've just scratched the surface. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Gareth Williams is an emeritus professor of medicine at the University of Bristol, also wrote the book Paralyzed with Fear, The Story of Polio. I'm Keely Boltina. The morning show continues just ahead. You're listening to the Ideas Network.